Trump has declared a national fertilizer emergency. Welcome. This is Bright Videos News for Friday, July 3rd, 2026. Happy July 4th for all Americans listening. Happy Independence Day. I'm Mike Adams. Thank you for joining me, and I apologize that my voice is still slightly wrecked. I made a very bad decision earlier in the week that wrecked my voice most of the week. I'll mention some details later. But I'll tell you what saved me is pine needle tea and shikimic acid. So I'll tell that story a little bit later. Anyway, just sorry about it, but I needed to do this recording here today because this fertilizer emergency is a very big deal. And it's exactly what I warned was coming. You know, people like Michael Yon, David Dubine, myself, and others, we've been talking about this since the Strait of Hormuz was closed, when Trump started the war with Iran. We've been warning about exactly this scenario, right? And we know that global famine is being engineered, but we also know that this war is causing extreme, acute fertilizer shortages, specifically phosphate fertilizers. So what President Trump just did is he signed Proclamation 11038 on June 29th, this week. He declared a national emergency over the threats to the availability of sufficient fertilizer supplies to meet U.S. agricultural demand. I'm reading from a summary of it. Now, what he's admitting is that we don't have enough fertilizer to meet demand, that we've run out because of the Strait of Hormuz. And it's interesting that this is applying to phosphate fertilizers, but we know there's also a big problem with nitrogen-based fertilizers, because of the link with natural gas that comes out of Qatar and, you know, the Haber-Bosch process and how we make nitrogenous fertilizers. But remember that phosphate is also actually even more important than nitrogen in terms of fertilizers. And it's the mixture of these two that makes, you know, a typical whole fertilizer. So without one of these components, you can't grow crops on the depleted, over-farmed soils that characterize the U.S. farming agricultural sector right now. So here's what else Trump did. He declared, or he invoked, Section 318A of the Tariff Act of 1930. It goes back a ways, huh? Almost 100 years old, the Tariff Act. This permits ending all import duties on food and emergency relief supplies for a temporary period of time. So what Trump did is he suspended the duty, or the import tariffs, on phosphate fertilizer from Morocco for 8 months through about the end of February 2027. So this was published on July 2nd, which is why we're just now hearing about it. And the Treasury and Commerce secretaries are directed to implement the relief. So why is this necessary? Because farmers apply more than half of the annual phosphate that they use between the fall and the early spring ahead of the 2027 planting season. So this is necessary to save the fall planting season for those areas where there are fall and winter crops, but also it's necessary to stock up for the spring planting season of 2027. Now, as I have said in my previous analysis reports, we already know that famine is coming to our world in 2027. And I've published infographics and I've mentioned which countries are going to be hit the hardest, including Bangladesh, for example, and Somalia and Yemen. We're going to have issues in India. We're going to have issues in Egypt and other countries. But what a lot of people aren't counting on is the fact that there's a fertilizer shortage affecting North America, farmers in Canada, farmers in the U.S., and also Western European countries, countries from which we get a lot of our food, including Mexico, Central and South American countries. So this is a global issue caused by the war on Iran, and finally Trump is admitting it's a problem. Now, this is apparently going to cut the cost of phosphate fertilizers by about 22%. And according to the USDA, this is going to benefit about 100,000 farms in America and 97 million planted acres. So this is a huge deal. Now, oh, I forgot to mention that sulfur is a feedstock to create phosphate fertilizers. And of course, sulfur and sulfuric acid are in short supply because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, which, you know, J.D. Vance ridiculously claims it's open again. In fact, there's more oil flowing through it now than before the war. You know, he actually said that in a recent interview, and all of us rolled our eyes. Oh my God, who is this guy? He doesn't even know. It's like, how did our national leaders have no idea what's happening in the world that they claim to run? They have no idea. It's incredible. And they certainly don't know anything about where food comes from and farming and fertilizer and phosphates and nitrogen and, you know, natural gas, any of that stuff. So apparently this has become such a big emergency that somebody grabbed Trump by his collar, you know, and shook some sense into him and said, for God's sake, declare an emergency, you know, something like that. And otherwise, there's no food. And so he declared an emergency. Here's the problem. This isn't going to magically make phosphate fertilizers appear. This doesn't create fertilizer out of thin air. So part of my message here today is that the famine is already baked in. It's a guaranteed famine. I don't mean in U.S. cities. In the U.S., we'll have shortages, much higher prices. We'll have a lot of people in the food lines and things like that. But in a lot of other countries, it's going to be extreme famine and death, like lots of people starving. Now, I didn't line it up this way, but this just happens to coincide with something you need to know about, and I'm going to plug my store, healthrangerstore.com/July4. Because we had already built up that landing page with the title, it says Celebrate Independence with Food Security. And we have specials on all kinds of food items, you know, that we manufacture and we sell and we do the lab testing. And we have almost everything certified organic, lab tested for heavy metals and glyphosate and microbiology and dioxins and atrazine for many different items as well. So we've got these amazing, this sale is going on right now, by the way. Just go to healthrangerstore.com/July4. That's the numeral 4. No space or anything. The sale's on right now. We've got free gifts. If you spend certain amounts of money, you get these free gifts. One of the free gifts is a pine needle spray with silver and iodine. This is the substance that just saved my voice, by the way, which I'll tell you about later. It's kind of a hilarious and humbling lesson because I made a huge mistake. But anyway, we've got items. We've got free gifts, doorbuster deals, 40% off some items, lesser savings on other items. We've got lots and lots of freeze-dried food in stock that we make that's ready to ship out of our warehouse in Texas right now. Plus, discounts off seed kits and multivitamin liquid supplements and, you know, all kinds of things. So I can't think of a better time to remind you of this than right after Trump declares a national fertilizer emergency, which is what I've been warning about this whole time. In fact, you may recall that in March, I mentioned on this broadcast that I instructed my staff to buy up all the raw food materials, you know, the organic stuff that we could find so that we could, like, pretty much restock our warehouse. Remember that? And that we moved quickly enough that we were able to do that. And because a lot of these food purchases take anywhere from 90 days to sometimes 120 days to actually get delivered, we are still actually in the process of receiving delivery on some of those items that we initially ordered back in March. So we haven't yet received everything, but we have a lot incoming. And what that means is that we are positioned as one of the few food providers that actually has the infrastructure, the warehouse space, the fulfillment center, the laboratory, the manufacturing, and everything to be able to bring you food in the middle of a global famine and a national fertilizer crisis that's been declared by our own president. So I would say we are well prepared for this. And as a result, you are well positioned, you know, to take advantage of this. If you need any food, superfood, supplements, any of these things that can help you through all of this, stock up now. Because I went all in and just gave the order to my staff, just buy up everything you can, because I know what's coming. And they did. And actually, not all my staffers knew what I was talking about. Like, what do you mean there's going to be a shortage? Well, just trust me on this. You know, just like with my lab. Remember, I had my lab people, I said, go out and buy a one-year supply of helium tanks, because we use helium in our lab for our mass spec instruments. And they're like, why do you want to buy up so much helium? This was in early March. And I said, just trust me, just do it. Just buy the helium. So they ordered a year's supply of helium from our gas supplier, and we got the helium, these big tanks that are in the lab. I was just showing somebody last week, and I was like, check out these giant helium tanks. I was like, that's a lot of balloons, you know. No, it's for the triple quad there. It's for the glyphosate instrument and, you know, the other instruments and the GC, etc. But then 2 weeks after we got our helium delivered, we received a force majeure letter from our gas supplier. And I also covered that on this podcast, because the letter said, we cannot guarantee. Then what did it say? The maximum amount of helium that we can give you this year is what we delivered to you last year. And I'm paraphrasing. And effectively, we can't even totally guarantee that. Like, we'll do the best we can, but force majeure. So I ended up being the only lab, or maybe the only lab in Texas, that's sitting on a year's supply of helium. And then I might be the only food warehouse in Texas that's sitting on a year's supply of food as we get into a fertilizer emergency. And I always hear from people like, how did you know? How did you know? I'm just like, dude, just listen to my podcast. I tell you how I know, because it's kind of right there. I'm not trying to be condescending or anything, but if you're listening to this, you know that we don't have like magic vortexes to see the future. We're just looking at the present. And we understand where food comes from. You know, we understand where energy comes from. This is not a difficult prediction. That's why I'm astonished that so few companies are able to make these predictions or projections, really. In fact, you know, there's only a few people that are any good at this. It's like Dr. Chris Martinson is one of them, you know, Peak Prosperity. And of course, Michael Yon and David Dubin I mentioned, and basically the guests that I interview, you know, plus myself and others in this space, we know what's coming, and we're accurate. And that's why we have all the supplies when everybody else has run out and is like, oh, we can't run our lab, we don't have any helium. It's like, well, how did you not know that helium was going to be in short supply when Trump bombed Iran? And they're like, well, we didn't know helium came out of the Persian Gulf. Well, dude, you run a lab, you should know where your helium comes from, man. I mean, it's like if you eat food, you should know where it comes from. You should know where fertilizer comes from. You should know how the world works. You're living in it. You know, fucking learn it. I'm sorry about my language, but I don't have time for morons. It's like, what are you? Are you like a human pinball in a pinball machine just bouncing around every day with no idea where anything comes from? You should know where everything comes from. If your life depends on it, where does your water come from? Where does money come from? You know, you should know these things. It's like life 101, as far as I'm concerned. Again, not trying to sound arrogant, but just sort of practical, just common sense. I mean, we're adults, right? I don't expect it. Teenager to know this stuff, you know, or a kid, but you and I, we're adults. Everybody should have basic knowledge about where stuff comes from. Now, especially when you consider the fact that this emergency invocation by President Trump, this does nothing to address the sulfur shortage. And this was actually pointed out by a company called Mosaic that is a phosphate, domestic phosphate provider. And Mosaic pushed back hard against this and saying that this is just going to make us more reliant on foreign phosphate, you know, from Morocco in this case, which requires shipping to function, and the ships require, you know, bunker fuel, and we know that, you know, fuel shortages are going to get worse, etc. But what Mosaic said, which is accurate, is that the real bottleneck in all of this is the unaffordable and limited or scarce sulfur supplies. So, in other words, until the Strait of Hormuz functions again, this is going to remain a problem. Even if you get phosphate from Morocco or anywhere. So, you need sulfur, you know, to make this whole thing work. And a lot of the sulfur and the sulfuric acid, as I mentioned, comes out of the Persian Gulf, which remains closed despite the, you know, the celebrations by Trump and Vance, who claim that they've beaten Iran like 40 times now. And I jokingly said today that we have the best military in the world. We can beat Iran 40 times and still beat them again next week before the markets open. It's like we can beat them every week. We can achieve total victory every single week over and over again. That's how great our military is. We're racking up the victories. Trump says he stopped 100 wars now. Or was it the same war over and over 100 times? See, that's... He should be guilty of trying to get the Nobel Peace Prize by counterfeiting peace. You see what I mean? Anyway, that's a different discussion right there. But Mosaic is correct. This doesn't solve the sulfur problem. We still have a structural shortage of sulfur and sulfuric acid, which means that Morocco or no Morocco, farmers aren't going to have enough fertilizer here in America for the fall and especially the spring 2027 planting season. So, what do you think is going to happen as a result of that? Oh, food prices are going to go up maybe later this year. Well, to some extent later this year for sure, but then significantly in 2027. Now, isn't it convenient that the government's consumer price index, you know, the tracking of consumer inflation, doesn't count food prices? What do you know? What are the odds of that, huh? They don't count food or fuel. Huh. So that's how they can say, well, inflation's only, you know, 2.3% or whatever they're saying. You and I know, it's like, wait a minute, food's going up 20%, gasoline went up a couple dollars, and now it's come down a little bit, but that seems really temporary because the war's not over, etc. But according to the government, you're not paying anything more for anything because they just don't count the things that are more expensive. So there you go. So, again, you want to get some food? We've got it. Because we planned ahead. We knew this was coming, just like you knew this was coming. So if you want to get some of our food, take advantage of it here. Our 4th of July sale, which goes through July 6th, by the way. It's like July 4th plus 2. That's kind of cool. HealthRangerStore.com/July4. That's the numeral 4. The number 4. July 4. There you go. And you'll see the landing page with all the amazing deals that we have there. All the discounts and the free gifts and everything. So, again, take advantage of that. Because this food's not going to get any cheaper. Now, in the meantime, what should you be planning on doing for, you know, 2027 and beyond? Because we're going to get hit partially with food price increases and scarcity later this year in the United States, but it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be end of the world in America or Canada or Australia, etc. Although things are going to get much worse in 2027. So what kinds of things should you be doing as you plan, you know, 2027? And how to reduce your overall food costs, how to become more self-reliant, and how to insulate yourself from the madness, which is this ongoing war, this war of choice that seemingly has no end in sight. And by the way, what happens if there's a naval war and the ships can't sail from Morocco with all the phosphate fertilizer? Then what? What's your plan then, Trump? Are you going to print fertilizer, you know? Ask the Federal Reserve to print phosphate? Hey, it doesn't work for any other elements. I don't think it's going to work for phosphorus either. But I don't know. You can try it. See how that goes. But first you have to build a giant fusion reactor, which might take 50 years. But in terms of preparing for 2027, what should you do? And again, I apologize for my voice. I'll tell you the story coming up here. But preparing for 2027, obviously plan to grow food. Obviously also plan to buy food in 2026, which will be at the lower prices that you can eat and use in 2027. In other words, buy what you know you're going to use. Buy what you eat, eat what you buy. You know, first in, first out, rotating the food supply intelligently so you don't waste anything that goes bad over time. So buy the food now that you're going to eat from us or wherever you can get it, you know, right? You can go to the grocery store and you can get bags of beans and lentils and whatever and rice. And, you know, you can pack it in your own pails yourself. And that's a smart thing to do. Buy the food now while it's cheap. I mean, it's cheaper than where it's going to be in 2027 is what I mean. Secondly, plan to grow. I know right now it's, you know, too late to start a garden in North America this year, probably, unless you're in certain states where you have a second growing season, like we do in Texas, by the way. We have a fall season in Texas, and those of you in Florida, you know, etc., California, you can grow year-round, right? I mean, certain parts of it. But most of you can't start a garden right now. But plan to start a garden in the spring of 2027, which means that you can be setting up the irrigation for that right now. Irrigation systems. And you know how I recommend the PEX pipes, the cross-linked polyethylene pipes, for any kind of irrigation project? And I use those pipes myself on all my projects. I use 1-inch PEX for the irrigation main lines, and then coming off of that, I'll use like a 1/2-inch PEX to go to like manual timers that have sprinklers or drippers on them, things like that. This is a great time to lay the 1-inch PEX pipe and to acquire all of the items that you need. Why? Because polyethylene is also going to be in severe short supply, because polyethylene comes out of the Persian Gulf as well as helium and sulfuric acid and nitrogenous fertilizers, etc. Yeah, it's all impacted. I'm already finding this myself. You know, I like to use what's called the Uponor, U-P-O-N-O-R, I think is how that's spelled, which is the expansion fittings for PEX pipes, you know? And you have to buy these polyethylene rings that clamp onto the, you know, the fittings to, you know, connect pipes and have T's and elbows and, you know, increase or decrease sizes, whatever. And those rings are becoming much more expensive already. And I was just buying some, actually today, some 1¼-inch rings. And they're a lot more expensive. And some of these fittings are very hard to find now because of the polyethylene shortage. So you could stock up on those materials right now, planning out your irrigation project for your spring garden. And you might think, well, this is going to cost me a lot of money today to stock up on polyethylene. But yeah, but what's going to be the value of the food you grow with it in 2027? That value is going to be much higher than what it is today. And frankly, also the polyethylene will be extremely valuable in the future as well. So even if you don't grow your garden, you could probably sell the polyethylene to a neighbor or another farmer who can't find it because it's out of supply because the war has gone on for 6 more months. Which is probably where this is going. I mean, do you think there's going to be peace? Lasting peace anytime soon? No. 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 I mean, if they wanted peace, it would have already been done. There's not going to be peace. I mean, the West won't want peace. Trump's going to take us all the way to the point of, you know, national destruction over this. It seems obvious. I don't think there's going to be peace for months to come. Maybe. Who knows? But I don't have faith that there's going to be any kind of lasting peace, which means that these shortages are only going to get worse and worse as we move through this year and into next year. Now, one of the things that you should be doing is planting loblolly pine trees. And let me explain why and share my story with you of what happened to me and why my voice is partially wrecked. It's super annoying since I'm a podcaster. So I made a mistake last weekend. I was invited to a private gathering of interesting people, and I made the mistake of going, and I just normally say no, but I went, and sure enough, somebody there must have been vaccinated and was shedding all over everybody. So we all got hit with some kind of like shedding spike protein attack or something. And it's not just myself, but some other people were impacted by this as well. And what happened is, for the first couple of days, I didn't have any symptoms at all. And then, like, the third day, I had a very minor symptom. I just blew it off, totally ignored it. I was like, I don't even get sick. So why should I, you know, I didn't even take any extra supplements or anything. Fourth day, symptoms started getting a little more severe. And the fifth day, it got horrible. And that I woke up, I guess it was the fifth day, kind of losing track. I woke up with my voice totally wrecked. And then I realized, holy crap, I should have been drinking pine needle tea this whole week because I grow loblolly pines. And so the mistake I made was that I neglected my own advice on natural medicine. I forgot to do the things that I advocate. Even when I just had minor, like, you know, nasal congestion and throat crap happening, even when it was just minor and I was ignoring it, I should have been smarter and I should have said, wait a minute, I need to do, you know, I need to drink some elderberry here. I need to dose up on zinc and vitamin C. I take those normally, but I should have been like mega dosing, you know, on vitamin C and other things. And, you know, quercetin. I should have been just nailing quercetin, right? But most importantly, I should have been drinking shikimic acid tea. Well, pine needle tea, which is very rich in shikimic acid. And so, but I failed to do that. And that's how my voice got wrecked. And I don't know if I have all the days correct. It was wrecked for a couple of days, and it's still recovering. I honestly wouldn't be recording today except for the fact that Trump declared this national emergency. I'm like, well, we got to cover this. But the thing that got me back from having a totally wrecked voice, because like yesterday, you know, I sounded like I didn't even sound human. I don't know. But what brought me back was shikimic acid. And so finally, I mean, it's so funny because I walk right by the pine trees that I grow, that I irrigate with the, you know, the PEX irrigation that I was just talking about. And I walk by these trees every day, and there it is right in my view, and I still didn't think that I should be taking that medicine. See, that's stupid, right? You know? that's why it's also humbling to say, even though I have a wealth of knowledge about natural medicine, it doesn't help you if you don't use it, right? So let that be a reminder to share with everybody. You know a lot of stuff. I know a lot of stuff. We're all very well informed. Doesn't help us if we forget to use it, does it, right? So we have to be wise enough to use the things we know. And in my case, it was even freaking free. All I had to do was just rip off a piece of like a little tiny branch, which is what I ended up doing, just a small bunch, take it in with a pair of scissors, like cut it up and put it into a pot of water, boil the pot of water and just let it steep for 5 minutes, drink the shikimic acid. Literally, what was it, 3 hours later, my voice came back. This stuff worked in hours. I happen to think there's also something really amazing about using live, like, you know, living raw pine needles that have, there's something that chemistry can't capture. There's something special. There's a vibrancy in it. So I was using, you know, living raw pine needles from the tree to the pot, and then drinking it within, you know, 15, 20 minutes, and then having this amazing effect within just a few hours after that. So wow, yes. So the lesson I learned is at the very first, especially if I've been around other people, right? Because that's the only time I get hit with, you know, spike protein shedding or whatever garbage, you know, people are throwing around because they've been vaccinated or whatever, or they've been mRNA'd over and over again. The only time that this ever happens to me, if I'm around like people I don't know, and I should be especially alert to that if I have, well, frankly, I should have been just drinking the tea that day. I should have just had pine needle tea every day. And I wouldn't have even had this problem to begin with. So there you go. That's a lesson that I learned. Again, sometimes we have to learn these lessons multiple times. That's called, I guess, wisdom. I don't feel very wise right now. So I have to be reminded the hard way, like, drink the freaking pine needle tea, you know, the inner voice, little judgmental right there. But I'm sharing it with you so that you don't forget to do something like that. Make sure you are taking the supplements and eating the superfoods and doing, you know, growing your fresh herbs and making your fresh medicine and doing what you need to do to take care of yourself, especially if you've been on an airplane or you've been around people, you've been in a crowd, you're out in public close to other people somewhere, whatever. You were riding roller coasters at an amusement park. Okay. Whatever you were doing, defend yourself against that. You know, defend yourself with good nutrition and natural medicine because it really works. What else? I was doing some really awesome essential oils. And, you know, I bought this copperware. From what was it called? Ser Todo. I interviewed the founder of Ser Todo, and I bought this copperware. So I actually ended up boiling the pine needle tea in this beautiful handcrafted copper pot. It was gorgeous. It was so wonderful. It was like, here's a beautiful element from Mother Nature that contains this beautiful medicine, also from Mother Nature. I felt like it was the perfect pot to make the perfect medicine, and then I poured it through a strainer into a coffee cup, also made out of copper from the same company, Ser Todo. And these cups are very expensive because they're all handcrafted, you know, and they're pure copper. I mean, 100% copper. I mean, I'm not saying it's probably like 99.9 something, right? But it's not copper plated something else. It's a copper cup. And then when you pour it in there, and that's when you're also reminded that copper is a great conductor of heat. And so the copper mugs are not cool on the mug handle like a ceramic mug. So just keep that in mind. I had to let it cool a little more before I could drink it. I'm like, well, I'm learning all kinds of reminders here. It's like, I love the copper, but man, it conducts heat very, very efficiently. And also, it conducts electricity efficiently, which is why we have copper wiring, right? So anyway, just admiring nature and the laws of physics and enjoying natural medicine and just getting great results with it. So, yeah, interesting stuff. Hey, by the way, you know, speaking of some medicine, our friends over at Limitless Peptides, they're also having a July 4th sale. And I'm checking it out right now because, you know, I use their BPC-157 and some of their nootropics. Here they go. They have a 250-hour sale that ends July 10th. 15% off everything site-wide. And you can also add our discount code onto that. And the discount code is RANGER. at least in the past, they've always allowed people to stack the discounts. So unless I'm in error, that would give you a shocking 30% discount off of their peptides, including their copper peptides. That's another one I love of theirs, is their copper. It's a GHK-CU. CU is copper. And they have a spray for that. They also have healing and repair research blend. They've got the BPC-157, as I mentioned, which I take intranasally. So all of that's on sale through July 10th. And you can find them at rangerdeals.com. Just click on the link to Limitless Peptides. Limitless Peptides. They're right there in the center, second row, at rangerdeals.com. And use discount code RANGER there, and you'll save an extra 15% off. Okay, so anyway, it's interesting. A lot of deep discounts happening on this July 4th. You know what has the even deeper discount? Is tickets to Trump's 250th anniversary state fair. I hear they can't even give the tickets away. Nobody's there. That was wild. That's all I have to say about that. It's like the only state fair that nobody wanted to attend. What's going on? Are people just busy, or are fuel prices too high? What's going on? All right, so anyway, I'm going to rest my voice now and keep drinking pine needle tea. That's why I grow the trees, you know, so I can have unlimited medicine. I'm going to rest over the weekend. You know that's not going to happen. I'll probably end up working on irrigation projects and things, and some solar projects and whatever. But I'm going to rest my voice. How about that? So I don't know that I'm going to have any new podcasts for you until next week. Maybe. I might run some stuff. But if I don't put out something new, I just want to say happy July 4th, happy Independence Day, and be safe. You know, obviously, with the fireworks and all, you know, all that garbage that's going on out there. If you're around crowds of people, you know, use natural medicine. Don't make the mistake that I did of waiting too long. So, let's wait till symptoms get bad and then use medicine. No. So just be more wise than I was this week, and you'll have a great time. And I'll be back with you early next week with a lot more interviews and podcasts and much more. And again, take advantage of our sale at healthrangerstore.com/July4. So happy Independence Day, everybody. And I'll talk to you again soon. Take care.
The food just keeps going up in price. I just don't see an end to it. So there's some relationship to not having enough of it, or people seeing in the future there won't be enough. And that's why the price keeps rising. I just can't see any other reason for these never-ending stepping up continuous price rises. And I don't see an end to it, and I don't think many others do either.
Welcome to today's interview here on brightvideos.com. I'm Mike Adams, and today we're joined by David Dubine from civilizationcycle.com. And David, of course, is one of our favorite repeat guests, and he's got amazing analysis of what's happening with crop production, with sun cycles, with weather. And right now, you know, the food shortages are coming, and they're going to be brutal. So welcome to the show, David. It's great to have you on today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And the food just keeps going up in price. I just don't see an end to it. So there's some relationship to not having enough of it, or people seeing in the future there won't be enough. And that's why the price keeps rising. I just can't see any other reason for these never-ending stepping up continuous price rises. And I don't see an end to it, and I don't think many others do either.
So talk to us about the main factors that are coming on, or that are sort of inbound factors. I mean, we know about fertilizer out of the Persian Gulf, but give us your breakdown of what that means. I mean, you know, for a few weeks, the fertilizer shipments still arrived after the war started, but those days are long gone now, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And chemicals as well. And, you know, everybody's talking on the fertilizer, but what about the insecticides and the herbicides and fungicides?
Yeah.
You know, the insects are going to have the best eating year they've had in a century. There's nothing to stop them. And, you know, once plants get weakened, they send out that vibrational signal that they're weak. and then the insects just come in. Because I got a friend down in New Mexico, and he's saying the locusts and the grasshoppers down there are just like nothing they've ever seen before, really? Eating through everything. That's just because there's extra precipitation. But, you know, once these things start getting into the croplands, there's no way to stop them with the traditional methods of insecticides. Herbicides, now there's a huge amount of competition weeds. So even when they're supposed to be planting with Roundup Ready GMO varieties, they don't have the herbicides to knock down the weeds. And then all these extra smaller plants are growing along, and the emergence is a thing being tapered with, or it's not as robust because what fertilizer they did have that they're applying on the fields is now being uptaken by those other non-target species of grasses and plants, weeds, for a better term, of just what would have been wheat or something else on the soy side. People just aren't thinking about that.
Well, I want you to help us decode the timeline here, because it's complex. You know, different countries have different growing seasons. Some countries got more fertilizer than others. Can you give us kind of a big picture view for those of us who are living in Western countries right now, US, Canada, UK, Australia, New Zealand, et cetera? What are we looking at? When are the food shortages going to kick in for us, if they do at all?
Yeah, that's the question, if they do at all, because now all of a sudden there is this talk of something called tank bottoms, which I hadn't heard before. But I did remember back in the COVID days when they said, we may need to lock you down. We might have to lock you down. And they gave us, you know, that nudging for about three, almost 4 weeks before they really started to lock things down, just to get your mind ready for it. So now they're talking about tank bottoms, tank bottoms, tank bottoms. So if that were to occur, everywhere in the world would experience shortages because the farm machinery wouldn't operate. But
you're talking
right
about
now,
tank bottoms of oil.
Tank bottles of oil storage facilities, right? Like the very large ones when you drive by those, you know, 50 foot tall, gigantic round ones that are 200 feet across, that sort of tank bottoms, or even right. Others that are larger of storage. So they need that pressure to push through on the pipes system, apparently. You know,
right.
First time to really delve into this, because why is it suddenly everywhere all at once, unless it's messaging being put out there?
Well, and
at that point, all food stops.
Okay. So I was going to cite that there are mainstream bank analysts from places like, I think, JP Morgan, that are also confirming this. They're giving a timeline of, I don't know, August or September, when tank bottoms are going to be felt more in the US, but in other countries, that's going to happen in July. So it seems like this is going to be a sort of a wave of tank bottoms. And from that, what happens to diesel fuel?
Well, what happened to all the shortages we were promised just instantly after this thing started across Asia? They still haven't manifested over here to any great degree across Taiwan and in Japan as well. I mean, you start to look at the different countries. Korea had its minute, but now somehow magically it has fuels again. You know, Philippines was saying, don't fly here. We can't get you jet fuels to get your return flights home. And suddenly they're flushing jet fuel. So, you know, I don't know how much of this is a mind game just to continually scare people and put them in a continuous state of fear for some reason. Because every time we come up to the precipice, it always seems to pull back again. And I'm wondering how much of this is real or how much of it is, again, just a ploy to get people to move the herd or move the school of fish in a different direction on either consumption patterns, usage, how they spend their money, the spending patterns. Because when things get expensive, you know, we're going to get into this period when if food, just for example, if you go back to Weimar in Germany, everybody would spend everything within, before the hyperinflation really hit, within 1 day of receiving wages, just to get rid of it because they knew next week it would be more expensive or next month's more expensive. Now, if we get into this fuel thing where there are limited fuels, we're going to get into one of these same scenarios where people will be paid, but they'll spend all of their money in a single day, especially on food, because they know when they get paid in 2 weeks or the next month, that by the time they buy it the next time, it will have gone up in price again. So you're going to get this rapid spending spike, and then the rest of the month will be almost nothing. So at what is this meant to do that, to bring us into this spending pattern spike and then down to nothing to try to disrupt the economy to bring us into a new economy. And there's so many other things that are going behind this, if you look layers deep on it, than just what they present you in front as the news of the day.
Well, maybe it's also a psyop to prepare people for energy lockdowns, to say, you know, you're not allowed to drive, or you can only travel a certain number of miles from your home, pretty much like COVID lockdowns, but now it's just saying we don't have any oil. And then couldn't they just force gas stations to close down in many areas? Just or just have them open one day a week or something like that, right? I mean, maybe that's what they're doing.
Well, that seemed to be the plan with a lot of the talk back in the Great Reset, and especially when COVID was going on and Klaus Schwab and that whole band of, you know, all those faces have sort of just disappeared. They're not even there any longer. Just a whole new set of faces have replaced them with new hopefulness. And then suddenly the same continuation of the agenda moves forward. Well, that was talked about. By 2030, you won't own anything. You won't travel. You won't fly. You won't have any private cars. And I mean, it seems we're moving down this path, whether it's planned from the beginning and implemented in a different way, or this whole thing is organic. Because at the moment's notice, at a flip of a switch, this entire thing could be stopped. If the Strait of Hormuz were to open and Trump would just step back and go, you know what, we've learned some lessons. Everybody be, let bygones be bygones. You guys be better next time, or whatever. if this could all literally be turned off in a moment's notice, but it's not. It's continuing to escalate on purpose for shortages. Plastics precursors, naphtha. There is a naphtha shortage out here, and Taiwan Petrochemical or Taiwan Plastics is not supplying up to Korea anymore for their film packing, what they need for their precursors for film packing, i.e. saran wraps. So Korea is going to be the first one in Asia that runs out of what you consider saran wrap, like food film packing, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So there are some disruptions in plastic, and Formosa Plastics is really pulling back to very minimum capacity on just keeping barely the lights on. Their minimum throughput is running through, and that is it. And their exports out of chemicals is their force majeure on a fair few things right now as well.
Yeah. Well, gosh, I don't know what Taiwan would do without plastic, because it's in all the shops, all the bags, you know, all the products that, I mean, it's not just Taiwan, it's every country. It's Walmart in America without plastics. But polyethylene comes out of the Persian Gulf, or the, you know, the feedstock for PE, and that's cut off. We know the fertilizer shortage is real, but it's not 100% of the global supply. But I want to come back to the question I asked you here. At what point are Americans going to start seeing partially empty shelves? I'm not saying they're going to be all wiped out, but when does the food choice become much more restrictive at any price? When does that happen?
When the plastics become less and less available to pack our foods, because if you go into any basic supermarket, you're going to find that it's all, even if it comes in a cardboard box, it still is wrapped in plastic. When you open that box up, it's got different layers of plastic, films, densities of plastics. The trays are a different thickness and hardness or rigidity than the actual thin plastic that's see-through that wraps that in and holds all those cookies or biscuits or whatever in place. Anything that comes in a Mylar pack bag, so those of you in the fast food arena that love everything, your chips are going to disappear. Whatever comes in those bags, when you rip them open, it has that silver lining in it.
Yeah.
Those things are going to go off the shelves as well. Like, we could have the food, and this happened in India, where the polypropylene bags just aren't there, still aren't there. That's the woven PP bags that they put rice in, very durable. But those bags are in very short supply, and it's disrupting the entire rice supply chain in India, where they're having to go back old school, where they're bringing out the trucks and they have to weigh it on a scale, this time digital, not the one where they put the weights on it. But then there's another person who takes the money and they're trying to streamline this delivery thing. So people are bringing their own bags, they're weighing it out, they're putting it in, then another person's taking the money. So even the food is there, but the delivery of the food out to a basic foodstuff in India is being greatly upset in upheaval at the moment. So they're trying to do workarounds just in India because they don't have the normal packing bags just for rice on that bulk item.
So this is going to cause a lot of spoilage in food. I'm sorry?
No, go.
I was just saying, this is going to cause a lot of food waste.
Get plastics.
I'm sorry, there's a little bit of a lag time. I think we're talking over each other. I was saying there's going to be some food, a lot more food waste because of the lack of packaging here, right?
Yeah, and then the choices of foods are going to disappear first before the actual food disappears, just because we can't pack it properly and get it to the supermarkets. If it's disrupting India on what we would consider a bulk product, then what is it going to do when you get down to the, you know, 100 gram or 5 ounce package of something or 10 ounce package? They're talking about disrupting on 50 pound bags of rice, 25 pound bags of rice. Well, they're kilos there, 10 kilo, 25 kilo, 50 kilo bags are not there. That's like 100 pounds of rice they can't get to somewhere. That's a disruption in a bulk item. Can you imagine? And again, bring that over here, how much more disruption that would be in the Western or Asians supermarkets, you know, and then if you go over to Europe, what could be there as well? I mean, the food could be here, but getting it packed and moved to a location for sale, is that's something totally different that not a lot of eyes are on. So for me, the fuel is one thing, and that's one layer to consider. But secondly, then what about the plastics?
Wow.
That's the whole thing too.
Yeah, that's something that not a lot of people are thinking about. Let me ask you also about, in terms of meteorology, we're being told that this is going to be an El Nino year with very warm ocean currents, and also even under the surface of the ocean, a layer of unusually warm water that's kind of working its way across the Pacific, kind of near the equator, I suppose, or thereabouts. In your studies, what does this mean to you when they're warning about a big El Nino year like we haven't seen for 50 years or something like that? I mean, in terms of crop production.
Well, they keep pointing back to the 1877 El Nino, where there was a huge loss of life on the planet because of, well, food production wipeouts. But again, we didn't have the supply chains. The Green Revolution wasn't there. They weren't producing as much food. So the last projections I looked at were 3.4 degrees Celsius rise in water temperatures. That's pretty much the average. Yeah, some were putting it higher at 4.5 or 5 degrees Celsius rise.
That's a lot. What?
Yeah,
that's
if you look at the NOAA projections on that, yeah, almost all the lines are running through there. That's not an outlier. That's the average. So it's something significant, and they're trying to frame it as the Godzilla Nino.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and you're looking at it and you say, all right, the news messaging rarely talks about weather events, but this one's being pushed heavily too. The Godzilla Nino, the Super Nino, they're laying it. They're really getting it thick. A lot of sauce on top of the meat here on this one.
Uh-huh.
They're putting that. And then they're putting about, well, there's not enough fertilizer, and you keep hearing this repeating. And now we got the fuel disruptions, and it's just, now it's just a drought. It's the biggest drought ever recorded in the Midwestern United States. We're at 55-year lows in wheat production, and it's just this layer cake that keeps getting pushed in the media. So again, are they messaging us in advance that food's going to get far scarcer, and will you need a digital rationing card to obtain it? We talked about this a couple years ago.
Hmm.
Like if we get into what's the messaging that they're pushing in the media is a full disruption in the food, not supply chain, the actual production of food, and it actually getting to a wholesaler before it can even get to a plant or facility to get processed. But you getting into the supermarkets like six steps away from where they're messaging that there's a huge disruption of it in the field. Everything's it's in the field. It's not growing.
According to what mainstream meteorologists say about El Nino, it's going to cause extreme droughts in some areas, and then later on in the year, extreme flooding, a lot of moisture in the winter in, you know, parts of southern continental United States, but droughts in other areas, possible temper variation, freezing of orchards in Florida, you know, over the winter months, for example. And practically the whole orange industry is wiped out in Florida anyway at this point. It's not anything like what it used to be. Does that all ring true with you? Or do you think this is some kind of a scare narrative? Or what do you think is real?
Well, the crop trading, I mean, they've been using this for almost 180 years to determine what the crops are going to do. This is not new science at all. This is you can go back literally almost two centuries on this phenomenon, on what happens in certain regions around the world. They have this mapped out to the nth degree. You can find dozens of maps, specifically continental, which continent, what happens, is it drier, is there more moisture? And that's how people will do their forward crop forecasting, based on La Nina or El Nino. Yeah, so you know, you have to look and see, and then the seasonal variance in that precipitation mix up as well. It's not just we having a huge El Nino year and then the entire year is disrupted. No, it's by seasons as well.
Right.
So
right.
You have to look in the winter season is going to be different with more precipitation. It's going to be a little bit snowier. It could be drier in some area, but then when you come into the summer, you know, it's going to be wetter and dry. You just have to look at the maps and see regionally where you are, what season you're in, and then how intense the El Nino or La Nina is on the effect. So you're looking at actually three inputs to figure out what it will do for your region. And then you can forecast it out. And again, this is a very, very old science on crop forecasting.
So
on these cycles, natural too, no SUVs required to create an El Nino. I wonder how the global temperatures change so quickly on a natural event, but that's never talked about.
That's interesting. Yeah. It seems like the food supply is getting hit with what we might call it, a triple whammy, right? So we have fertilizer shortages because of the war. And then we have oil or diesel shortages also related to that. And there's sabotage apparently of refineries and oil storage and then draining down the strategic reserve, et cetera. And then on top of that, El freaking Nino, you know, these three, this convergence, it sounds bad. I mean, it sounds like it could be a catastrophic convergence in terms of reduced food supply. But then again, are they exaggerating it on purpose?
I don't know. You forgot the fourth and the fifth, though. The fourth would be the mega drought that hasn't been experienced in a century and a half across the one of the largest growing areas on the planet, in addition to Ukraine still being offline, which is one of the largest grain producers in Europe. And now I would going to put look for all the insect pests and the plagues to come in, whether it's rodents or whether it's insects. We're just going to get hit with something unusual this year. You know, if you're looking at biblical plagues, and a lot of people are looking at end time prophecy here of just so many strange things occurring that seem to be lining up with what was foretold would occur, to look for these signs. To have another insect outbreak that would devastate and actually just roll through with no protection because we don't have the chemicals on an insect outbreak would take our crops down to zero, and it would be reported on the news, and it would be an end times, you know, type of fitting in right in that same genre, and it would spook people. It really would. If we have the largest locust in 150 years come and visit our crops, is going to scare people. There won't be much left of them. They'll be eaten to nubs. But that, I would say that's a fifth layer you could think about as well.
Okay. I have an inflatable globe with me here. You see that?
That's a great one. You take that to the beach.
Yeah, take it to the beach. You can play with the world, or you can be like Atlas Shrugged and have the whole world on your shoulders. tell me, as I rotate around, here we are in the Western Hemisphere here. What do you see for this part of the world, North, Central, and South America? What should we be mindful of for the rest of this year and into 2027? And then we'll rotate to the East later.
Yeah, in the South America specifically where you're at, Brazil's been having just some unusual and bizarre flooding events. Like what you consider, this will be the year of the flood for South America.
Wow.
Like they're harvested already because it's in the middle of winter down there. But when they were coming into their harvest, the machines were getting bogged down in the fields because it was so much rain at the end of the year, which they're not used to. And some of the areas they couldn't get to, and different varying crops, and they started to sprout on the head because they just couldn't get to it. It was stranded. They weren't going to harvest it anyway. But the amount of rain that was just ferociously continuous was, it started to sprout off the heads in the fields there. So Brazil and all of South America, incredible wet. If it stays, now that could still be some residual moisture from the Hunga Tonga eruption finally coming and drifting out of the atmosphere.
Oh, really?
Because you got to realize that Hunga Tonga eruption was in the southern hemisphere at about that same latitude going across Brazil there. It was about 20, 22 south. So when you draw a direct line around there, that water vapor eruption would be hanging in that same, coming right over the Brazilian grow zones down in, you know, a little bit further south into Uruguay, Paraguay there. Okay. So wet is the name of the game. And wet. For us, it snowed unbelievably. They don't have the exact snow totals, but some areas registered 36 inches in Colorado with this freak snowstorm. Other areas were like 4 or 5 inches, but they had some outlier areas. It did bring a little bit of moisture, but a snowstorm that ferocious this late in the season, a little bit uncommon, not unheard of, not, it never happened before, but there's a slight amount of moisture coming in our Midwest grow belts, which should help. But then after this, it goes right back dry again for like 2 to 3 more weeks. So our areas in what is considered North America and Saskatchewan and those growing areas up in Canada are just, they haven't seen these kind of conditions before. I mean, this eclipses Dust Bowl dryness.
And I notice the aquifer, the main, I mean, multiple aquifers, the Ogallala, the Central Valley Aquifer in California, are both running really low. I mean, the Ogallala in some areas, the well failure rate in parts of Texas is 30% right now. I mean, right now. And, you know, according to the projections, there's only one farming generation left in a lot of places in Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas because of that aquifer. And then the Central Valley Aquifer is, of course, heavily stressed out of California. Seems like in the long run, we're not going to be the breadbasket of the world anymore in North America when that fossil water is used up, and it's happening very quickly. Are you seeing the same thing?
I am. The data centers that are competing with us for our food supply, you know, we as humans and the data centers as an electric intelligence or an electric consciousness are both competing for the same resources to keep it alive. We need water. It needs water. So this is the most important thing. The food it requires is, well, what we need to stay alive too. So with all the push toward data centers, and I know Texas is a hotspot for this, then, you know, we're coming down to the literal choice of humanity here. Do these data centers get more water than we do? Because somebody is pushing the water and turning off water to humanity to allow it to go to the electric consciousness. And also what's strange is I pulled up a rainfall map. You can find all these general rainfall maps for El Nino. Generally, when El Nino kicks in, which it hasn't really started super heavy yet, we get wetter in the Midwest grow belt. But trending in, it's already begun this El Nino. You think we would have already gotten precipitation there, but we haven't. And what's interesting, in South America, it's generally dry when it comes into El Nino, but it's been incredibly wet. So even the what you consider the cycle of the Nino is the opposite in two different continents, which is also strange to think about. That there's some other driver happening beyond what has been known for the last, say, 200 years on how weather patterns are affected during these warm Pacific episodes.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I don't know how we're going to grow the food any longer unless they really release that water for humanity to use it versus, I mean, it's already been heavily used anyway, bringing it into cities. That's one thing where there's definitely a component to that where there's always been this duality of give it to the cities. We'll give it to the ranchers, give it to the farmers. Well, now we got, do we give it to the city? Do we give it to the farmers and the ranchers, or do we give it to the data centers? Because right now, especially with this drought forming and the aquifers going, you know, way drier, shall we say, in depth, and who really gets the resource to live?
I saw that the data centers will be consuming hundreds of billions of gallons of water a year by 2030, which isn't that far off. Hundreds of billions of gallons. And the U.S. has more data centers than any other country in the world, of course. And a lot of those data centers are in water-stressed areas like Phoenix or in parts of Texas or even, you know, Las Vegas or Reno, probably more data centers there, parts of California, et cetera. But let me move the globe here to now Africa and the Middle East here. Don't include India. We'll cover India later. But what do you see for the Middle East, Africa, Egypt, Turkey, you know, all of that in terms of food, not war, but just in terms of food, what are they going to be facing?
Well, the West African monsoon seems to be becoming more and more and more intense, and that's a once in a 4,000 year cycle that is really driving a huge amount of above ground rainfall. And you can also see all the way over to where Ethiopia is there in the New Renaissance Dam, like that entire belt of the north of Africa is getting vastly more amount of rainfall from above. So that is greening. And a lot of those countries are getting and pumping in record crop production like Tunisia. Morocco came out of a drought and they're back in into good production again. And Egypt had some really good production there for a minute. The outlier is there's so much burning and so much, you know, detritus in the air. And you think about all the military over there. Everybody's yapping about global warming. Don't raise any cattle here because, you know, cow farts. You got an entire military over there running 24/7 oversight sorties. You got carrier groups running. I know the carrier's nuclear, but their entire support fleet's not. You got all these C-130s blasting back and forth. You got the refueling tankers out there. You got just in... The world's military is on the move and things are burning endlessly in the Middle East. So the weather patterns have been changed regionally there to more rainfall. There's like incredible amounts of years worth of rain in a day. I think it really has something to do. Now, I think you've heard the same thing where generals always talk about these fierce and ferocious battles after that type of military conflict, a big battle back in the day. Would always rain after because of the amount of gunpowder and smoke that went in the air would cause rainfall to come. Well, this is no different. You got continuously burning oil wells, and there's just so much smoke in the air. And again, all the extra emissions that are around there in the air. Because you ever watch tanks move, it's just pure black coming out of the back there. And you can see that with so much of the military hardware. Like the entire atmospheric mix in the columns in the atmosphere because of the different smoke and particles and this thing in the Middle East is causing more rainfall. That's a weird, that's a strange phenomenon that should be studied and will be studied in the future on how war is affecting dry climate precipitation patterns.
Wow.
So I'm calling more moisture for that area. And they've been having a lot more moisture south near Yemen. By the way, you know, 800 AD, this place was, it was called the Marib, M-A-R-I-B dam. And it was the main water source to then take irrigation up through the frankincense plantations to power that whole frankincense trade.
No kidding. Along,
no, yeah, all the way along the Red Sea going up on Western Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
That was a captured spot for all the rainfall that was coming down on that, you know, boot that's coming down there where Oman and Yemen are. And the empty quarter right now is really starting to get a lot of rain where some of these sand dunes are filling up and becoming small lake regions. Or sand dunes, you know, they're not that big themselves, but when tens of thousands of them fill up and it looks like just sand sticking out of the water, like a shallow lake with sandbars sticking out of it, which is interesting too.
Wow.
So there's a lot of history showing that these areas were once very, very wet, lush, and always had rainfall. You don't build dams in these areas and then put irrigation canals out unless there's something there to catch continuously. So
right.
Wind back the clock, getting wetter again in Africa and North Africa for sure.
All right. So next, let's take a look at India, China, Southeast Asia, Myanmar, Thailand, you know, all of this. Bangladesh is going to have all kinds of challenges here. What do you see for this area? I guess we could include Japan, Taiwan, South Korea, etc. What do you see for this whole area of sort of East Asia?
Well, India just itself, every El Nino, dry as a bone there. So it gets really, really dry. Although I follow a couple, there's a site I follow called Kashmir Weather, which follows up there in Jammu and Kashmir and that whole Himachal Pradesh area weather. Bizarre this year too, completely out of the normal. They're getting massive hail storms and grapple storms, which is just one step below. It's like a mix between snow and ice. Out of season rains and the snows have lasted tremendously longer. First, they had a drought where there was almost nothing, and they're like, there's no snowpack. We're not going to be able to, you know, keep our animals alive this year. There's nowhere to keep. There's no rain. And then suddenly it's come, but it's months late, and it's extending even now. I was just looking a couple of days ago, and they've had just massive hailstorms once again. Now, hail and tornadoes in Kashmir is not – it's the first tornado that they've really recorded, apparently, in history. But
wow.
And I'm sure there have been some records before that have been lost. Yeah, in Kashmir, made all the news over in India about how strange this tornado was in Kashmir. Huh. So that whole area itself, you know, you can go on projections of what the averages were over the last 200 years. But if we've got a magnetic field shift and a lot of different displacements now happening in the jet streams, you would expect the same exact phenomenon. Because all along Western Saudi Arabia, it's just been record flood after record flood for the last 2 years, which means that, you know, that giant mountain range coming out of the Red Sea there before that west to east pattern was almost directly west to east, where all that moisture and cloud would block and hit. And now it's shifted where it's stopping on the mountain and dropping out versus passing around it. So that shows there's a new airflow or, you know, moisture flow in there too. And that would be more just because the flows in the upper atmosphere are taking the actual clouds themselves into a different direction that allows that to bunch up on the mountains versus passing them to create that dryness. So because if it doesn't stick, it doesn't stick. It just passes. But now when you're ramming all that in there, and the same thing up there, and it seems when you're getting up into the Himalaya, before it would go a side pattern where it would pass and you get the monsoon. But now it seems it's driving straight up in there and then everything's raining back out. Because Pakistan and Afghanistan are experiencing the same thing where the lowlands come out and rise up into the Himalaya. Generally, it was a west-east pattern where it would literally skirt those mountains and stay in front of them. But now it seems to be getting rammed straight into the mountains and all that moisture's coming out. Well, that's a global difference. That's a global disruption or a global restabilization into a new weather flow on that, on a new jet stream flow.
So
same thing in the Middle East. Yeah.
So we're talking about different changes in what will be the breadbaskets of the world, right? So massive changes of you know, culture and GDP and imports, exports, routes, et cetera. It seems like America's days of being the breadbasket of the world are limited, you know, and these other areas, parts of Africa, like you said, will be more green, and that'll be a lot of the farming hubs, you know, 25, 30 years from now. Am I on the right track there with that? Is that what you're seeing as well?
It is. And, you know, just a fact for anybody out there that wants to have fun with your trivia friends, you know, the new Renaissance Dam was supposed to take between 7 and 9 years to fill. It filled in 2 because the weather patterns are changing. That moisture flow coming off of the Arabian Gulf there is onsetting way faster than anybody ever anticipated. See, somebody who built this, and you have to go back 20 years. You're in one of the driest places in Africa, and you want to put the largest hydroelectric dam in Africa in one of the driest places. The only way you would possibly do that is if you knew something would shift and it would be usable in the future.
Uh-huh.
You can't. There's white elephant projects. I get it. But this is so far outside. This is like a Six Sigma white elephant. Like, you would never in your mind consider putting that in that area, but they did. And then now there's 6 more of these dams under construction, stepping down off the Ethiopian Highland Plateau.
Wow.
So we look at this, and, you know, can I say one thing?
Mm-hmm.
There was a standing army of about 10 million men who are no longer there because they're all up in Europe now. So at the same time that this construction of all this new agricultural infrastructure in the lines out, I mean, they're having battles in Sudan over the electric lines, like who's going to control the flow of electricity pulling off of those lines in these areas. That Sudan, southern Sudan area, they're running electric off of these dams everywhere to push in and try to develop. That area of Africa is going to be the most highly developed, the fastest developed, the most wealthy part, because they're going to have constant electric. And now the armies are battling in Sudan. Who's going to control the throughput and the right of way of where these electric lines are going to lay down? So the men that would have resisted, you know, Western occupation coming in again to set up all the farm machinery, set up all the canals, get all the, well, we need. So imagine that moving the Midwest grow belt over to North Africa and the Sudan. Like, all those men that would have been there to resist and go, you have to pay us part of the profits. No, you're not going to take my farm. This is our family's land. We've been running, you know, our buffalo here or planting this for, you know, 4,000 years. You're not going to come in and just take our land. You're going to pay for it. No, 10 million of them are up in around the world in different parts of the place. There's no resistance any longer. That was a 10 million man standing army that just went on their own to greener pastures. So, you know, a lot of these things overlay on themselves, like, wait a second, it's getting green there, and now all the fighting men are gone. So you could just kind of walk in and
And a lot of that was because of the mass migration that took place to Europe over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Well, not just Europe, but other places around the world too. I mean, Europe is the focal point where we always see it, but I mean, take a look at Australia, look at North America here. And it's happening everywhere. It seems like wherever what is going to be the new growing areas on the planet are being emptied out.
Hmm.
The prime croplands will be empty when corporations get there. If it is, it'll just be the women and children holding down the village when they get there. All the men are gone.
And then the new agricultural approach is going to be highly automated with machines and robotics and autonomous tractors and things like that, right?
Yeah, they're going in fresh, so they can start fresh. It would be more difficult to do it where we are now because there's already entrenched entrenched infrastructure there that would be difficult to... You know, there's a completely built out system. It's very much easier to start from the ground from zero than it is to scrape away an entire system and then replace it with something else.
Right.
Maybe that's a naive look at it, but I think it would be easier to go from ground up, starting with all this new, like I say, autonomous. They could put the towers wherever they need them to be to connect with the machinery. There's no NIMBYs, not in my neighborhood, not in my city, not in my farm. Oh, there's nobody there to say no. So they can place the towers where they need for all the autonomy to occur, whether it be robot guard dogs on the crops because it can be valuable, or whether it be the machines or the tractors to plow or whatever it would be.
Okay, so spray. So big long-term changes in where food is grown, but also short-term crisis over the next months and couple of years everywhere in the world because of fertilizer and oil and diesel and maybe weather patterns as well. Is that an accurate forecast, you think?
I think it would be, and they have to teach us the value of food once again. Because right now, everybody's so used to having food so free, so cheap. It's just a given that we have food. Now, when you take that right away, or that just ease of the mind that there'll always be food, we're going to have to rewind the clock back to, I would say, go back to the shekel, where the grains of wheat were measured against the silver, not the other way around. Like, we use the money today to buy the food, right? But back then, the grains of wheat were the silver. So we have it opposite today as the way it had been most of history, where the food was more valuable than the metal. We traded the food against the metal weight. Today, we trade the metal weight to get the food.
Uh-huh.
So if we rewind it back then, like, how scarce would the food have had to been? When you were paying people day's wages in grains, you know,
right,
cups of grain, quarts of wheat, quarts of rye, like, that was the payment for soldiers and those that were working. You paid them in food. Like, how valuable would it have been than the food? Like, we have never experienced anything where the food becomes that valuable that it takes on a different role of itself being currency in the society. I think maybe they're taking us there at the same time, could reset a lot of different economies as well on the way.
Mm-hmm. Wow. There's even scripture about that, right? How many, what was it, denarii for a bushel of wheat? What does it say? Talking about, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse and what's coming with the famine, the war, that kind of thing. I'm not saying that that's for sure describing this moment in history, but to a lot of people, it's going to feel like the apocalypse when food becomes very scarce or very expensive, and fuel becomes scarce and expensive at the same time. You know, I mean, we all lived through COVID, and those lockdowns were crazy, but that was a single cause event. You know, that was forced shutdowns that could be reversed overnight. You could turn the factory back on. You didn't have a supply chain crisis during COVID. Not at first. You had a shutdown, an artificial shutdown that could be reversed. This is totally different now. This is way worse than COVID. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's going to take a minute to turn things back on again. It's not, you know, just if you're listening out there, even if we did the Hormuz Straits unblocked tomorrow morning, you're still looking at 9 months at the minimum before fuel supplies get back to what they were before this event.
Yeah.
So something that easy to smooth back out. Now, turn back on all the plastics factories that turn themselves off because they don't have enough throughput. They just turned off. either they come back or they don't. And it could take a month to turn one back on. You know, there's a, getting plastics back online is going to be a bigger one too. Like, Mike, think about a list of things. Like, once they don't have enough material to put through to run the factory, like, you turn off rubber production would be one, plastics would be another, glass would be another. So, I mean, how long does it take to turn these back on again?
A long time. I mean, a long time for many of them.
Yeah, some refineries might never come back again either once they're turned off. That's difficult. Yeah. Like BASF with Michael talking to him, Michael Yon. And once they turned off BASF, the pressures dropped. And there were some areas that they had never turned off in almost half a century. So to repressurize, they didn't even know how to do it. So once the plant went offline in many sections, BASF in Germany, never coming back online again, ever.
Yeah, well, a lot of that's moved to China now. All right, so I want to give you a chance to wrap this up. Let me give out your website, civilizationcycle.com. And what do you want to, you know, what should our audience take away from this as the big picture here? I mean, people are concerned, but how do they get their minds around this and get a clearer picture of what's coming?
To measure the correct thing. Right now, everybody is focused on energy, but they're focusing on the wrong kind of energy. Calories are the most important energy unit on the planet. Oil and natural gas are second and third, at least. Calories are the number one energy unit to be measured. When that disappears, everything else in society stops. We don't have a civilization if we don't have calories. So when you're looking at units of energy and people are talking about energy disruptions, you need to put calories at the very top of the list. And once you start to look at it that direction, it'll make a lot more sense on what needs to be first in your preparations for your families in terms of trying to stock 50, you know, gallons of gas and get fuel stabilizer in there. You need to think about calories, stabilizing those calories first and foremost.
Yeah. Yeah. Home gardening, food storage, sprouting, local farms, all of that. But we talk about that all the time. And
all the time. Nobody's ever listened. I mean, very few. Thank you for those of you who did listen. Your job as a father and a household leader is to get your families ready and prepare. So if you did listen, thank you for doing that. Yeah. So many people aren't these days. They just kind of go along blindly with whatever's said here, there, and in the news media. But that is your job as a household leader to prepare for these events. And I'm glad some people did, but I would say probably the amount of people that, you know, listen and took heed and, you know, got these warnings and took action is just percentages of the whole. It's not even remotely close to 10%. So there's only going to be a percentage of the world's population, or at least the United States, of people who listen to Mike and myself talk about grow your own food, know your farmers, get all these community gardens together. You know, there's literally just a few percent of people that have taken action to that.
True.
The rest are all unprepared. And that's another thing you'll have to worry about too, is all the unprepared that know you're prepared.
Yep.
And that's a whole other broadcast on itself. You know, far better than I would just be repeating things. Yeah.
Well, this is the time for people to take seriously the advice to grow your own food. Cause you and I, David, we've been saying it for years. We practice it ourselves to some degree. And yet, you know, a lot of people just haven't found enough justification to do it. Well, now there's a justification if you needed one, here you go. And even for the food that's still available in the grocery store, prices are going to be through the roof. So all of a sudden, gardening is going to become a cost-saving measure, not just a, you know, let's not starve to death measure. We're going to save a fortune on food just by growing some. Anyway, anything else you want to add?
No, just please prepare. It's a mental game here, too. You're going to have to realize, you can go back in history book. Like, your history book is a crystal ball for what's about to happen, and look at different chapters in history. I would encourage you to look at Germany post-World War I. That three-year window is about where we're sitting right now. Like, things were sort of stable, and then they weren't, and then metals became more expensive, and then they dropped in price, and then the food became more scarce, and then it's just following very similar to what happened in the Weimar Republic. So how is your spending habits going to change when these prices continue to rise? Because they're not going to go back down. Like, this is the cheapest you will ever buy it ever again, at least in the next decade or so, maybe two. So how do you prepare for that? And how do you, you know, shift spending habits? Do you buy bulk food? Do you get crock pots so you can cook home cooked meals and, like, drop everything in and walk away, come back 4 or 5 hours later and a meal's ready? And these, they're going to be specific and very large changes in just the way you prepare food and handle food. You're going to need to go to bulk foods. I mean, you're going to have to know the very value of it, just like we know the value of a penny, or well, not a penny anymore, it's gone, but a nickel and a dime. Like, you know what that unit means. Well, you're going to have to understand food units too. So if you're going to trade with somebody or barterables, and you're going to have to understand silver and what that's worth, and you know how much food you can get for it. You're going to have to know the value of each food item, at the least the basics. So if you want to swap it one for one or two for one, you're getting a fair value. Like, there's a lot of things that are going to change. And I would just like say, your crystal ball is a history book at this point, because we're in it and we're deep getting ready. We're in the impact zone at this second. So just understand that and accept it. It's part of history. We're the very luckiest part of our civilization for the last, say, 5,000 years, that it's been this stable for the last 200 years. Yeah, we're just coming out of the stability period now. We're in nothing new. This is nothing, you know, like, it's just happening. This is the normal way that the world used to be for 5,000 years. We have been blessed.
Yeah.
We have been blessed for 200 years of stability. Wow. But this is ending at the moment. So,
and we've also had, you know, 75 years of artificially low interest rates and high liquidity, lots of easy, you know, lending, and that's coming to an end also. So there's a whole financial realm that's about to crater for different reasons, but at about the same time. Well, David, thank you so much for spending time with us. We really appreciate you. Again, your website is civilizationcycle.com. You want to mention anything on your site that you want people to look for in particular, or of your
podcast
work?
You know, please support me on the podcast. I'm trying to get more traction on that. And thank you for those who do listen and comment, because these conversations, you know, this what Mike and I talked about, I'm going to turn this into a podcast and get it out there for people to digest on, chew on, because it's all about having the conversation and then, you know, having people, the ability for them to share it with others to get them in on the conversation, because we're never going to do this alone. We need to have these conversations. And I think people are more open to it now because so much strangeness.
True.
If COVID wasn't strange enough to wake you up, this whole set of events has probably tipped people over to the edge where they're more willing to listen to things. And if you heard something in tonight's talk that was really interesting that you hadn't heard before, and you're like, wow, hey, uncle, hey, dad, hey, mom, hey, sister, brother, whatever, wife, husband, please, you just sit down and listen to this for a couple minutes. That's what the reason we're out here, to just share all these things. It's meant to share. We need the conversation started because we're literally out of time now. There's no more preparing for it. It's here and we're in the midst of it. So we're just going to have to go with it as it increases in intensity.
Yeah, totally valid. Really appreciate you, David. Keep doing what you're doing. Stay informed.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you on. We got to sound the alarm for people so that we can make it through all of this. And I think your information is absolutely critical to understand what's coming. So thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day there, or early morning, I think it is at the moment. So enjoy that. And thank you for joining me today. And for those of you watching, you can catch more interviews at brightvideos.com. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. Been teaching food self-reliance and nutrition for 25 years. You can also read my articles at naturalnews.com. So thank you for listening today. Get ready. Take care.
Stock up on the long-term storable Ranger Bucket Set. 536 servings of clean organic superfoods for your survival pantry. Certified organic and lab tested for purity. Order now at healthrangerstore.com.